It's Wednesday, August 30th, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, well, a weird week for the Republican Party. We'll talk about the Republican debate from last Wednesday, how the moderators moderated, what the candidates had to say, and the elephant not in the room. Former President Donald Trump arrested and processed the next night in Fulton County, Georgia. We'll talk about the coverage of that and CNN's move into its Max era with a new addition to an existing streaming platform. We'll talk about the strategy and what makes this any different than that failed CNN Plus app. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but we're going to start with exactly where we left off last week when we ran out of time, talking about the developments in the decades-long saga of Michael Oher and the Toohey family. You might remember them from the book or the movie The Blind Side. Oher is now 37 and retired from the NFL, and he's filed a lawsuit in a Tennessee court claiming that the Toohey family didn't adopt him as he had believed and as they had, according to him, had said, but entered into a conservatorship similar to the one Britney Spears was in, and that since he was 18, the Toohey family has profited off of his name, image, and likeness, including with the publishing of Michael Lewis's book and that 2009 movie, both of them called The Blind Side. Now, Sandra Bullock won an Oscar for her performance in that movie, and for many years, it was kind of seen as this really inspirational story, this storybook portrayal of a big SEC family adopting a black teen neglected by his drug abusing mother, cheerleading his way from SEC football into the NFL. Its popularity has faded in recent years as those white savior themes became more and more evident to audiences and was acknowledged. I think that's part of what's made this story such a talker for people. This idea that this is somebody who people have now seen that perhaps he was taken advantage of from day one.
Well, I mean, you know, part of this is, again, this is the other part to the story. The other part to the story is that this had been out for a very long time. Michael Oher had been talking about this when he was first drafted in the NFL, saying that the way in which the story is depicted in the movie, what came out in the book, is not necessarily what actually happened. Because if you look at the book, I mean, look at the book, and if you look at the movie, you would think that he was was with them for a very long period of time. No, it was only maybe a year, 2 years that he was actually with them. Mm-hmm. And so because people have this sort of movie depiction of what happened, and now they're hearing the fuller story that's been out there for a while, they're starting to question it. And again, like I said, Michael's been talking about this for a while, and he's been trying to get this out. Now that you have him actually filing a lawsuit challenging the conservatorship, where you're starting to hear the rest of the story, and you're probably going to hear more once this goes to trial, if it ever makes it there.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that as I understand it, Ernest, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, the conservatorship is still extant.
The family is
now offering to end it, but it's incredible that he's now, what, 37?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that this family still has some sort of legal control over his finances. I'm actually surprised this hasn't blown up long before. I mean, that to me is the big question, is why didn't he sue earlier, and why haven't we heard more? It's just incredible.
I think that's where the rest of the story is going to come into play. And I think his retirement is probably what triggered what the events that we're seeing now. While he was in the NFL, while he was under contract, there may have been some stipulations that would not have allowed him to do what he's able to do now. At least that's the story that's being spun right now, at least among legal, the legal community who's looking at this. So it's going to have to either play out in court, or it's going to play out in some sort of settlement before we really find out what's going on here.
Yeah, it also raises, you know, I think it's going to raise questions about the journalism here, because Michael Lewis, who wrote the book, is a very respected journalist. He writes one best-selling book after another on some really complicated topics. But the fact that he didn't really unearth this in the course of his storytelling, it does make you wonder. You know, we always talk in the newsroom, you know, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. In other words, if it sounds too good to be true, you might want to be skeptical. And it just does make you wonder how he could have missed this.
A combination of missing it at the offset and also not following back up with
it at any point, too.
Like this 18-year-old, after college, what happens as he goes into the NFL? What do some of those business relationships with agents look like? He obviously has worked more than one contract as a professional football player. So as those are renegotiated, looking at it again with fresh eyes as the story continues to evolve, as some of our societal norms have also begun to evolve.
And I think that that's what's played a role in the way in which people are looking at this now is the societal changes. I mean, we've gone through one sort of crisis after another along the racial spectrum in this country, and this sort of begins to fit into what we're starting to see, what people are reevaluating a lot of the stories and a lot of the myths that are out there, and this is one of those that they're actually looking at as
And
well.
I'll say, when this did first break almost 2 weeks ago, I texted a friend, and the first thing I said was, at what point do the cable networks shelve this movie? Like, we're not watching The Cosby Show on TV every day, and they're not exactly the same situation, but at some point, as those shifts are happening, at what point does this movie go away too? Does this not remain in the TNT or TBS or USA regular weekend rotation?
It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because I mean, I was thinking about that when I'm flipping through channels.
Right, like it's one I go right past every single time.
Really?
It's still in the rotation. Yeah, I would say easily once a week, if not more regularly.
I think at this point you're probably going to not see it in the rotation as much as we've seen it previously.
Okay. Well, if you were here with us last week when we ran out of time to talk about that, I used our last minute or so to ask Kathy and Ernest whether or not they would be watching the Republican debate that night. I hadn't planned to, but Kathy changed my mind. Kathy, you sold me on this. You convinced me that it was going to be an opportunity to see who might step up and lead, who was willing to go out on a limb. You watched it. You texted me it a couple times during the debate. What did you get what you were looking for?
Well, I think what we've seen, we continue to see the Trump effect, even though that name was not mentioned until well into the debate. But the way you see it is the kind of loud, interrupting, trying to squeeze in my soundbite. I mean, so many of those lines had clearly been rehearsed beforehand. And so that was a bit disappointing. I do think, though, that for people who want to see what the Republican Party is all about and its disagreements, it was better without Trump on the stage, because it would have been all about him. And I think there were some really interesting debates about abortion, about foreign policy,
immigration.
And I also thought what was really interesting to me was what hardline positions a number of the candidates took on issues that really put them at odds with what the polls are telling us the American public feels, particularly on abortion. That was one. But I think, and then you saw the real schism in the party over Ukraine. I thought that was really interesting. So I think for somebody who's getting ready to vote, it was a worthwhile thing to watch. And there were some new faces there.
Yeah, there were definitely some new faces there. I mean, if you haven't sort of looked at the clips of Vaswami, I think if I'm pronouncing that
we're
right.
We're actually showing him on our screen right now if you're watching
you know,
show.
He is a, I mean, if he is probably right now, other than Trump, the master of the one-liners. I mean, he's got it down to almost a science and very simple terms as to who he is and what he stands for, and he speaks in a very upbeat tone, but it's an upbeat tone against a whole lot of stuff. You know,
yes.
it's real interesting.
It's a very negative message, but it's a very upbeat tone.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we saw a lot of that. I remember it was either doom scrolling or crocheting or something when it was on, and I heard him say that climate change was a hoax. And I remember looking up at the screen in one sentence, as succinct as possible, going, yes. Wait, what? What did I just hear him just say?
And that was the other issue where I thought that was really interesting, because they introduced that segment with a young man who was a young Republican. Uh-huh. I think he was with an organization. I can't remember. But he said, what do we tell people to let them know that Republicans care about climate change? And wow, what an answer he got. So I texted a couple friends of mine who were still active in newsrooms, and I said, find that kid and interview him. You know, what did he think of the responses? But I thought that and abortion were really interesting in terms of these Republicans are just saying, nope, this is what we really think. We should keep burning fossil fuels.
Exception of Nikki Haley.
Right, yes, I was going to say, yeah. Nikki Haley sounded
a little bit
reasonable. Yeah.
Well, she was more to the center, but
yes,
I think, but not,
reasonable.
You know, but not.
But what the thing that highlights, at least for me, with Nikki Haley was that she was like, look, we are going to get beat on this issue if we continue down this road. That is basically what she was saying. And she said that unequivocally.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. She's like, look, we are going to get, we got beat in the midterms. We could get beat in the general if this is the road we're going to go down.
Well, and she also pointed out the fact, she said, we don't have 60 votes in the Senate and we're not going to have for a long time. So that's a basic civics lesson that a lot of candidates omit. I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that as president. Well, no, you're not, because we have checks and balances.
See, and that's where I thought
right.
she sounded reasonable,
yes.
because she was bringing pragmatism
yes. yeah.
in explaining how and why this stance of the platform, of the party platform, is not going to be possible.
Well, and I think because, you know, politicians should understand that if you raise people's expectations, you know, elect me and, you know, the world will change, they're just going to be terribly disappointed, because that's not the way our system works. Unless you have a Congress that's 100% with you, it's very difficult to do that. That's the way the system was created, checks and balances. She acknowledged that.
So you also mentioned, Kathy, that there was no mention of Trump for more than an hour into this debate. Was it a strategy that you think worked for Fox News and for the moderators? Or do you think it was that elephant that everybody was waiting for and it was all they were going to talk about anyway?
No, it didn't work. Yes, it was an elephant in the room. He took the spotlight back the next day, which we'll get to in a minute.
Right, we will in just a second.
But, you know, again, it was everyone was sitting there waiting for mm-hmm. it, knowing that it was going to happen, you know. And even as the moderators tried to prepare the crowd for it coming, they still lost control.
With the booing, turning around and having to tell people to, like, chill.
Exactly. And even acknowledging, okay, we're about to go into the segment where we're going to talk about former President Trump.
Yeah, and that is the... Well, I think they did as best they could. You know, they it put it off long enough to at least give the other candidates a chance to have a little bit of TV time, right? But I think when I said, you know, Trumpism is still there, it's that failure to follow norms. I mean, the idea that you would just boo somebody down or you
interrupt
could just,
them.
Yeah, interrupt. And that, I think, that is really an unfortunate development.
Okay, so by Thursday morning, all eyes were on Donald Trump again as the hours tick down to his negotiated surrender in Fulton County, Georgia. It happened around the dinner hour here in the Central Time Zone, and the processing took a mere minutes, with the president's mugshot and booking record coming soon after. So let's talk about less about what happened and more about how it was covered. MSNBC brought its A-team in, as it has for a lot of the ongoing Trump coverage since the first indictments coming back in the spring. And it seems to be a strategy that's really paying off, as it's showing that ratings are growing for MSNBC right now, whereas Fox News and CNN are struggling a little bit in some of these bigger news days.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, it was only 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And at least the portions of MSNBC that I watched, I wasn't able to watch it when it actually happened, but I was watching some of the coverage later that night, and they were pointing out that it only took 20 minutes, where usually in a normal booking setting, it would have taken a lot longer than that. He was able to bring in his own. Usually when they go through these booking processes, they take you through a whole bunch of
it's a process. Tests. That's why it's called a process.
Exactly. And he came in with his own medical records.
Right.
And provided them, whereas if you
were 6'3 and 215?
Yes.
I want to say 6'3, but I can't remember if that's what it is off the top of my head. The 215 stuck with me.
But, I mean, here's the thing. They usually do all of that while you're there.
Right.
They just accepted what his medical records that he produced himself and brought, and they accepted that. And there were a couple of the commentators going like, whoa, wait a minute. He was afforded special privileges that others wouldn't have received, and we were told that that wasn't going to be the case prior to. So I think that kind of questioning and really going at it is something that MSNBC was really talking about, that sort of gave them a little bit of an edge because they were willing to do that, that the other networks, Fox, of course, is not going to go down that road. But
oh,
CNN
no. Jesse Waters came right out and said that mugshot looked good and hard. Read into that.
Yeah, can I just say that the mugshot looked like the Donald had been practicing that for days.
MSNBC actually said that, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it looked like, he would. That was a very well-rehearsed mugshot, yes.
And of course, they're now saying that he did that because he wanted to use it to raise funds, which is what he's doing now.
Which is exactly what he's doing now. So I want to go back and talk about Fox News again, but another story, actually, one that is now unpublished and apologized for. It goes back to an article that ran in late July, which claimed the family of Marine Sergeant Nicole Gee had to pay in upwards of $60,000 to transport her remains to Arlington Cemetery following the attack at the Kabul airport 2 years ago during the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Fox News said that it had gotten its information from freshman Congressman Corey Mills of Florida, but the story started to crumble when the family disputed the claims and issued their own apology for any misrepresentations of the situation that had been made by others. Now, the story isn't on the Fox News website anymore. Kathy, you had actually found a copy of it through the Wayback Machine.
Yes, yeah. Well, they took it down, which it was a mistake. And, there are different ways to handle that, but they might have been under some threat of legal action. They probably wanted to be safe rather than sorry, since Fox has had a series of legal problems recently. The Pentagon was really upset.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, this really illustrates a point that we often make in journalism classes, which is you may get somebody who seems to be a figure of authority telling you something, but you need to ask, how do you know that? Because we certainly have plenty of examples of elected officials popping off and not really having any basis in fact, and that's what happened here. And the first thing when I looked at this story that struck me was, what is a Florida congressman doing talking about a Marine or a soldier from Northern California? What would the special information that this member, that this lawmaker has, why would that be there? So again, as a journalist, I think you would want to go and say, how do you know that? And then the other big missing piece in the story, there was no comment from the Pentagon or from the family.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a one-source story, and that is dangerous because clearly the one source was wrong.
To me, the other thing, too, would be, okay, why this Marine and not another Marine? Because in that attack, there were several who died. So if I'm the reporter, I should be thinking, wait a minute, okay, if we have this one that you're saying, what about the others? I mean, you know, if the Marine Corps is not going to pay for the transportation of that serviceman or servicewoman's body back, it has to be more than just one. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was the thing that sort of popped out at me, other than the fact that Fox has still refused to apologize, which I'm going like, come on, that's an easy one. You could easily apologize for that.
And they've apologized to the family.
Right.
But for no other way, in no other way have they apologized for what has been some irresponsible journalism. There is a piece on our links blog from the Washington Post that is interesting because at the very tail end of the piece, it brings up the 2017, the story that Fox had from 2017 about the death of, and I want to make sure I get the first name right because I'm thinking about somebody else, Seth Rich, because I almost said a different first name. Seth Rich, who died, and how his murder has not actually been solved, but Fox News tying it to the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's emails. And I kind of saw where this writer was going here with that idea of the conspiracy theories that Fox News was trying to, well, Fox News was, I don't want to say trying, but connecting back to Democratic administrations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a reach in terms of the writer of this piece. I would have stopped, I would have ended the story with this story and not connected it all the way back to that because, you know, again, you're talking about a different time, some different circumstances, that sort of thing. I just, again, connecting a 2023 story to a 2017 story, I have some issues with that.
I think the only common thread there is because, you know, the Seth Rich story was an actual coordinated campaign by Fox hosts to really like to get this crazy story across that somehow this young man was killed in some political operation, which but this was just, you know, a dumb mistake. Both of them have at the heart a form of confirmation bias, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. our audience will love this. So let's go with this story. Exactly. And so, again, this gets back to old Walter Williams saying, you know, bribery by one's own pocket is as much to be avoided as bribery by another's. If you're saying, oh, I mean, it's so good for our audience, you really need to check it three times or four times.
I agree.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so it appears that the suits at Warner Brothers Discovery are inching closer to naming a new chief at CNN to replace Chris Licht, and this week announced a new initiative, the launch of a new vertical on the Max app full of fresh and sometimes live CNN programming. Now, this sounds an awful lot like CNN Plus, that standalone app that lasted, about 2 or 3 weeks?
Yeah. Hugh Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. We have all been here before.
So that led to massive layoffs, right? What is the strategy for rolling this, like relaunching it and rolling it up into an existing app?
I don't get it. I don't. I mean, that's just not the way that people consume cable news. And how they're going to do this, I have no idea. Again, are they going to, say, have, you know, Anderson Cooper doing sort of 60-minute type pieces on a rolling basis that people can just automatically stream? Well, guess what? Paramount already does that.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I just don't see where this is going.
The only thing I can potentially see is that it's an existing app people are already paying for, so it's providing added value to the Max user. Right, exactly. But I still don't see it because the appetite isn't there for that kind of content in that way.
No, I think, I'm trying to think of it. I don't think that's what people use apps for. I mean, it's a question of convenience. And I really, if you were going to use an app, I would think it would be for, I need to know this piece of breaking news now. Let me go to my CNN app and get it. But to try to repackage existing content, I don't think that's what people are going to be going to their apps for. I go to my KOMU app to find out what's happening right now and what's the weather going
to
be.
Exactly. And when you go to Max in a situation like this, you have the layer of opening Max. Then you have to go through HBO. You have to go through Cinemax. You have to go through Sesame Street. You have to go like all of these layers to get to the content you're looking for. And it's not there and it's not user friendly. Yep. Before we go, we've got another update on Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich. He appeared in a Russian courtroom last week, only to have his detention extended through November. The order keeping him jailed ahead of trial was set to expire today, actually. But the Moscow City Court extended the custody order by another 3 months. These proceedings were held behind closed doors, journalists being kept outside. According to TASS, the Russian news service, this is because the details of this case are classified.
Yeah, this is all too expected, unfortunately. It's a really painful situation for his family. But I think the family is doing everything they can, and other news organizations are doing everything they can to keep the pressure on our government to keep the pressure on the Russians, but there's just not a lot of leverage when you're dealing with Vladimir Putin, who doesn't seem to operate by the same set of rules as the rest of us do.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Gershkovich, you got Whelan, who's still there, has been there for a while. I mean, there was a report yesterday that I think I heard on NPR of some footage of him in prison and how he's doing. And that's putting even more pressure on the Biden administration to deal with both his situation as well as Gershkovich. And it's, to me, it's just one of those things where you've got Ukraine, you've got Putin, you've got the death of Prigozhin earlier this week, and that's now been confirmed that it was his body, mm-hmm. and it just seems that, you know, Putin and those who support him are sort of becoming entrenched, and in many ways they are going to use whatever they can, be it political prisoners, be it assassinations, be it all-out war in Ukraine, for him to stay in power.
Yeah, it's an absolute pariah state. And yeah. I think that makes it really difficult if you are working on Evan's case, because we certainly want his name to be out there, but the more you raise that profile, the more valuable he looks to mm-hmm. Vladimir
right.
Putin. So
mm-hmm.
it's a real dilemma.
Well, and you talk about, you know, that continued pressure, efforts among journalists and private citizens as well to keep his name out there, keep talking about him. There's an article on our Links blog. The Online News Association held its this has been the season of journalism and journalism yes. educator conferences. And at ONA, the Online News Association's conference last week, efforts that were made there as well, and some of the details of that are shared on our Links blog. If there is any good news, it does appear that from what we heard from the ambassador last week, that he seems to be in good health and spirits where they could be.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. There are a group of journalists. There are, sadly, a number of people who have been in a similar situation, mm-hmm. like Jason Rezaian and David Rode. And they are actually talking to his family mm-hmm. About how to get through this. I think the other thing is, he's a journalist, mm-hmm. so he understands the situation he's in. He took that risk himself, and he's showing a really strong backbone.
Okay. Well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our Links blog. You can find that under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is at Views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Kia Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher did our theme music, and Nate Brown is our social media manager. I'm Amy Simons. We'll be back with you next week.